Okay. That's okay. I just turned it back on.
I think there should be an earlier.
Oh, before January 06?
September 05, I think, which is around the time of his research report, the first shorting.
Do you know if, so these have a date right here. There are some other copies in the production that don't have dates on the front. Do you know if
why? I think the September
they're shorter.
05.
Okay.
But we produced a text version that had it. It's my understanding. Oh. I can give you the base rate.
Okay. Okay. That'd be great.
Okay.
Thanks. We can do that after.
Okay.
Thanks. I appreciate you clarifying. Did you guys ever talk about fraud in the mortgage market, or did you ever look at any data on mortgage fraud as part of your analysis?
The answer is yes. We come across with a lot more heavier early payment defaults starting, I think, in late 05 and definitely going into 06. And so we were saying, like, who took out the mortgage that do not want to pay the first three payments? You know, like, it got to be some sort of fraud. So to us, fraud has several layers. The first layer, very obvious one, is the outright fraud. So we had some cases where the mortgage was supposedly on a house, but the house did not exist. So that's outright fraud. Some of the frauds were more nuanced, such as appraisal. You know, like you have a inflated appraisal, we would think that's a fraud, or inflated income number. Sometimes about the occupancy. I heard a Fannie Mae analyst told me that they trying to do a search of, you know, like, mortgages by the social security number. And because they have, you know, own a lot of mortgages, right? So they, in some extreme cases, the same social security number may have like 40 mortgages.
Where would this data have been?
I should say I never saw that data. I just was told, right? You know, like a Fannie Mae analyst told me about that.
Do you remember who?
I don't remember the name. I'm sorry. It was a long time ago. They are all owner occupied. So to me, that's a fraud as well. So
the application says that they're all
owner occupied, and so you know, those are all kinds of things. The mortgage fraud that's being perpetrated, and unfortunately there are in terms of the data that are available to us, it can't be that apparent from just from looking at the data, because you the data itself was in a way that you don't really cannot verify whether this guy, you know, we don't know the borrower has the occupation of the borrower, so we have no way to know whether his income was accurate or not. But for the lender, they should know much more information than us, and we don't know the social security number, so we cannot do the same analysis that Fannie Mae guys did. Our tools were much more limited in terms of uncovering the fraud than just you know, looking at losses. So when we know this by the post fact, you know, like someone like do not make the first payment, you know, this guy has no intention to pay his mortgage, so we know it's fraud. Yes, but anecdotally, we heard a lot of horror stories about this, and we feel that, you know, it's getting more serious towards the, you know, 2005 and 2006.
So would you have been able to factor that into sort of your quantitative analysis, or would it have just been anecdotal evidence that supported what you were already seeing?
We were trying to, you know, model that factor in, so to speak, but it's not, it's, but the certainty on that factor is much less than on the other factor. For example, FICO score, so it should be pretty good, you know, like pretty recent and so on. But in terms of income, you know, like the state of the income loans, we generally do not know who is more honest, who is more, you know, like a liar. So we would just take a haircut. You know, once we saw this is a state income loan. So we assume that everybody is kind of a liar, but not, you know, like a egregious liar. So we take a haircut on that. And
what was the size of the haircuts that you would take roughly?
Sometimes 15%. That's not... In some cases, I heard that people exaggerate their income by like 100% or more. So like 15% is not perhaps, but on average, you know, I think that works. So,
did it change over time through the course of your doing this analysis starting in 05? Did you tweak those assumptions?
It does. We initially we were more taking like a 5-10%. Then, you know, like over time, it's getting heavier. So. So yeah, so some of those things you just have to live with.
Do you think the rating agencies changed their assumptions?
They did over time. My understanding is they start to become much more bearish than they were in 2007. You know, they changed their rating criteria, so now they anticipate much more losses.
So you said that you did try to build fraud in to the model. How would you have done that? Was it just through sort of taking the haircut on the stated income loans, or were there other inputs to the model that would have reflected this?
At times we try to, you know, like factor in certain lenders may be a little bit more prone to this because their systems somehow did not weed out as aggressively as someone else.
So I think it's interesting that you raised that. One of the slides that I had noticed was, I think it's slide 11 in the 07 one that I gave you. Is it 11? No, that's not right. There's a slide in here somewhere that shows what the biggest lenders were and which ones are regulated.
Yeah, I remember that slide.
I wrote down the wrong slide number in my notes. Give me 1 second. Oh, it's 39. Right. What's the when you were and Mr. Lippman were pitching this deal to potential investors, what point did you make with this slide? What's the impact of this?
Part of that was most of the big lenders are not regulated, and therefore there are fewer eyes watching over their shoulder so their loans are, you know, more susceptible to the, you know, the lax of the lending criteria.
So not just fraud, but
yeah,
or maybe not even fraud. Would this have also been part of the fraud piece, or was this just a point about underwriting standards?
Well, I think it's more underwriting standard. We were not, you know, there is no base to accuse anybody, you know, like purposely, you know, like allowing fraud loans to go through, but. I think, you know, when you know, as investor, you probably would be more comfortable if you are investing in mortgage. You know, you go with the those ones that's more careful and have more regulations. You know, regulators watching over them. So that was our central point.
Since you had such a wealth of experience in the mortgage area, I'm curious, because people have called no-doc loans liar loans.
Uh-huh.
Is that a term that was used during the time frame 05 to 07?
That actually came from somebody, you know, it's not, you know, when we start to, you know, talk to those hedge funds, some of the hedge funds start, you know, like first calling them the liar's loans, and a kind of harsh word, but in some cases they are, you know, really people are inflating their income to we have wage earners to take out a state income loan, and to me that's a flag.
So what was the increase, and I apologize for not knowing this data off the top of my head, but since, and if you don't remember, that's fine, but do you remember there being, noticing a dramatic increase in stated income loans?
Yes, over time.
Were there headline events that you remember on that front?
I don't remember the exact percentage, so I, you know, do not want to hazard a mistake here, but I think, but I remember there was a dramatic increase over time. Around early 2000, there is no, very, very little state income loans. And later on, like by the time 05, 06, it's substantial portion of any typical subprime mortgage pool.
Without any additional information on those loans, would you have thought that they were more prone to fraud, or?
Well, they are our flags, you know, like raised. You know, like we all know that state income loan charge extra interest rate. A wage earner, why would a wage earner want to take out a state income loan if he has W-2 to substantiate his income, right? So, you know, I can understand, you know, like, you know, if a self-employed person who wants to, you know, take out state income loan for various reasons. But for a wage earner to take out state income loan, well, you can argue that he might have a second job or something like which, you know, like he, you know, takes the tips or whatever. But suddenly so many people of, you know, getting to that situation, to me it's kind of troublesome.
And was it troublesome to you at the time?
Yeah. It's, yeah.
I noticed you have a few pages in this presentation about manufactured housing. I can guess, but why did you include these pages and what your, it's I think 37, 38, or maybe others. What point were you trying to make?
I guess it's, we were trying to say, you know, yeah, the triple B pieces can take losses, and sometimes it takes surprisingly large losses. And MH is a very appropriate example for it.
So am I reading this correctly to say that on page 38, you're saying that triple B manufactured housing bonds that were originally issued in 1998, 45% of them had a complete loss?
Yes.
And of those issued in 2000, all of them had a complete loss.
Yeah.
And by implication, the rating agencies perhaps got the rating of these securities wrong?
I don't know if I would put the wrong you know, term this as a rating agency, put it wrong, because we know ratings is only statistical. And, you know, when they put something as triple B, they did not say it cannot lose. And they're just saying they view it as, you know, the probability of losses as low. How low is that B is, you know, it's according to their model. And we were just pointing out an issue. You know, I think it's fair to say that in structured product area, rating agencies' track record was not as good as their corporate, you know, rating area. So was it fair to say, you know, they're wrong? Honestly, I don't have an answer. How should they rate it? Because, you know, to me, I would say, you know, like imperfect is probably is a better word for it. I don't mean to, you know, like to play the word game. It's just like, you know, if you say something is wrong, then it begs the question that what do you think is right? I don't have that answer. So,
someone else said to the commission that they thought that the rating agencies had a difficult time distinguishing between low quality borrowers and fraud. Do you agree or disagree with that comment?
I tend to agree. I think nobody at that time realized the extent that how crazy the housing market was. We heard some extent, you know, anecdotal evidence, but nobody actually had any statistics. FBI may have some information about, you know, the mortgage fraud, but it's not published. And maybe I'm wrong, but to the extent that, you know, I know the data is very sparse on that. So I won't be surprised if rating agency a kind of, you know, not that well informed in that area. Some of those, it's, you know, it's very hard to put back to that time, you know, like, because everybody is like, you know, like you're talking about, everybody thinks that home ownership is good, like we want the low income people to, you know, to have a chance to own a home, and so giving them like a loan with very little or no equity, you know, a down payment, was thought a good idea. If they, you know, like even the GSE, the Fannie and the Freddie, was have some like a streamlined criteria to lending out loan, which basically it's almost like the state income loan. You know, it's very, it's not a complete state income loan, but it's streamlined. So you get through an express lane to get a loan. So everybody thinks that's a great idea. And on the ground level, homeowners or, you know, potential homeowners are worried about that they actually, you know, home prices are actually getting, you know, expensive by days. And if you're not, you know, find a way to get a house, it may be you cannot get it, you know, later. So like, you know, if they're doing all sorts of things trying to make that happen, right? And it was that, you know, in hindsight we all know this is the problem. But at that time everybody thinks that, you know, this is the way it should work. It has low risk and we should do it.
I just want to make sure I didn't miss anything.
Yeah.
So is there any other point beyond these charts about manufactured housing other than saying triple B's can experience?
Yeah, because believe it or not, a lot of investors will say, how come these things are, you know, rated triple B, right? Well, you know, if they measure triple B, should I, you know, this thing has already, you know, triple B pieces, they're trading at 150 over LIBOR. Corporate triple B are trading like double digits over LIBOR. So I'm paying like three times shorting your stuff than shorting a triple B in corporate world. Why would I do it? Well, we're saying that we think, you know, triple B can really get into trouble. Here is some example, you know.
Distinguishing corporate from something else in the housing market.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know a little bit more. We talked a little bit earlier about you went on the early pitches and it was primarily hedge funds. I just wondered if I could get you to talk a little bit more about perhaps if that process changed over time and if the responses that you were getting from people changed over time. Because I think you said a lot of people were skeptical at first.
Yeah.
And I wondered if I could get a little more detail about your experience over time. How many people would you have met with on a monthly basis? And when did you start to see, if at all, more people sort of coming over to your point of view?
It could be. It comes like sometimes I met, you know, 3-4 clients in a week. And sometimes, you know, like none in a week. So on I don't know the average how many. Some clients are going back, you know, like several times, because the first time I talked to them, you know, give them the presentation, the second time they had a lot, you know, follow-up questions, they want me to come in again, so I go there again. And so it's hard to say, you know, on average how many, but it's fair to say sometimes we worked pretty hard trying to convince people on the merit of the transaction.
In the book, I think it mentions Steve Eisman's hedge fund, Front Point. Do you remember?
Yeah, I actually, you know, I spoke to them. I think I spoke to them over the phone. I don't remember meeting him in person, but I spoke to him, you know, on the phone.
Maybe it was Mr. Lippman. I somehow recall the book saying that you or perhaps Mr. Lippman had gone to them several times, that they were a reluctant investor at first, that they were with you on the general story of being bearish on the housing market, but maybe a little more skeptical on how it would work, investment.
I could, you know, remember this incorrectly, but I don't really recall meeting Front Point people in person. You know, I probably talked to them over the phone, but I could, you know, it was like, you know, like 4 years ago, you know, only 4 or 5 years ago, so could misremember that.
So do you have a recollection of whether people's sentiment changed over time?
Yeah, I remember meeting with a hedge fund person and trying to talk to them about this, and they're very sophisticated. They're one of the very large funds, you know, in the area. So,
which one was this?
Marathon. Yeah, and
they
were very reluctant, not because they don't believe the analysis. They basically saying, you know, there are a lot of other factors that can, like actually come into play and make the trade not working.
Well, and you actually had to pay up front, correct?
You pay monthly. You pay monthly, but you know, people thinking that this is basically wasting money. You know, people can, you know, there are a lot of factors that they think that, well, actually, you know, being a government intervention or on the servicer level, you know, servicer could lie, you know, like, you know, So.
What do you mean the servicer could lie?
Well, they say they perhaps buy out loans, you know, default loans, to make it like look like a prepayment. Yeah, and a lot of this kind of thing can happen. You know, like it's all valid point, but our point was the problem is such a big problem. You know, it doesn't. You know, it's not likely to be masked just by doing some of this kind of thing, you know, because eventually the losses will be so huge, nobody can afford to buy all the losses out. And,
Were you, I don't know if you'd be the right person to answer any questions about this, so just tell me if you wouldn't be. Would you know very much about the details of how the contracts worked, how the credit default swap contracts worked, and the provisions of the contracts?
I perhaps do not know 100%. I'm sort of go through this by, you know, I, you know, talk with other investors on how that works. So I probably know like most of it, but there are finer points that probably would consult with someone more, you know, closely working on that.
Do you think you remember enough? Could you just explain to me how they worked?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's called pay-as-you-go CDS, credit default swap. So the way it goes is you basically sign up, the two parties just sign up a contract. One party would be a protection seller, and other party would be a protection buyer. So the way it works is there may or may not be a front point means that the money changed hands in between the two parties. In the beginning, when the spread was very low, there is no front points. So basically, let's say I want to buy a CDS on XYZ. Okay, XYZ being a mortgage bond. Then we agree with a coupon that's, let's say, 100 basis point.
May I just interrupt for just one moment? Would the mortgage bonds have been RMBS or would they have been CDOs?
I'm talking about RMBS, but CDO has also, you know, the similar concept of the you know, CDS. But you know, I'm only talking about the RMBS.
Okay.
So let's say the coupon of the protection, the CDS, is 100 basis point. So every month, let's say the notional, you agree with a notional balance. Let's say a notional balance of 10 million. So every month, the protection buyer would pay, you know, 10 million times 100 basis point, which is 1%, divided by 12.
So 100,000?
To 100,000 divided by 12.
Yeah. So it's 100 basis points a year, but you pay monthly.
Yeah. Okay. To the protection seller, right? And if there is any pay down, because it's called a pay as you go because it's trying to mimic the payments in the bond. So the real bond has, let's say the real bond initially was 20 million,
okay,
the entire tranche, right? In 1 month, it become 19 million because 1 million has been paid down. Then your protection would decrease by 1/20 as well. So now instead of paying 10 million times 1% times divide by 12, you just divide, you know, times this by like 19, you know, like 0.95. Okay, so it paid down. Of course, you know, you pay less coupon now, but also your potential to get reimbursed by losses is also disappear by 1/20, because initially you can collect, if the entire bond is wiped out, you get all your money, you know, 10 million reimbursed. But if now it's only, you know, 0.95, you know, so it's like only 9.5 million you can collect from the protection seller. So you sort of do not want this to pay down, the bond to pay down. Now, so the thing is, what you're looking for is the actual bond that's the CDS reference to will experience a loss, right? Let's say it loses 5 million out of the 20 million total tranche, then you collect 2.5 million from.
And that's not that it goes down because of a prepayment, but that's
a loss.
A default, because mortgages have defaulted, causing losses to
the bond.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're basically looking for.
So tell me your example again. You just said you'd get paid out something.
No, let's say the actual bond has, you know, initially had 20 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now it experienced a loss of 5 million.
Okay.
Then the protection seller would have to pay, because 5 million out of 20 million is 25%. The protection seller has to pay 25% of notional to the protection buyer.
So 25% of the 10 million.
Yeah, of the 10 million to the protection buyer.
And that happens on a monthly basis?
It happens on a monthly basis.
So you wouldn't have needed. Well, let me ask a different way. So all of the deals that Deutsche Bank did were CDS on BBB bonds. Is that correct? Transactions?
The
default swap transactions?
We're making the market. You know, the market, we're making the market mostly BBB, BBB minus, but there are times with other tranches, like single A's and double A's. And there are times like we even, you know, would sell or buy protection on triple A tranches. So, you know, like ABX is a very good example. ABX is, you know, it's very similar to the single name CDS. Single name by, you know, in reference to an individual bond. ABX, instead of in reference to an individual bond, it reference to a basket of bond. And but this concept is very similar. ABS single A as triple A bond. You know, initially all these ABXs, you know, are trading around the par, meaning that everybody is, you know, anticipated there is very little chance to loss. Later on, the triple A price dropped as low as to, you know, like $20 out of $100. So like it lost 80%. Not necessarily, you know, it's like the market believe they eventually will have such a huge losses that, you know, it justify the price of 20 cents on a dollar.
So I want to distinguish between the two if I could, because I think what you were describing earlier was actual losses to the bond, not a decline in the market value of the bond. And then yeah. I think I heard the description of the ABX as a decline in the market value of the bond.
Well, yes, that's correct. But the thing is, the price would reflect the market anticipation of the actual losses. So if it's traded at 20 cents on the dollar, you would only accept to sell that index at that price, because you agree that the losses will eventually hit, you know, like almost more than 80% will be wiped out.
In your opinion, did the market ever reach a point where the market price wasn't reflective of the actual losses that should be expected? I mean, this is a point of some debate, I think, around sort of collateral calls on various.
Well, I think there is definitely a market sentiment or the technicals that come into play. In some cases, like there are people like just want to, you know, hedge their risk, and they're willing to pay more to that hedge, right? So it does not necessarily, eventually losses are the future events. So you cannot for sure to know that what kind of losses would be until it actually happened. So the market anticipated. So we can say we believe the losses will be here, but the market act like the losses will be there. So the market is wrong. But, you know, it's not really market is wrong because we think it's wrong. So, yeah.
Did the, to your knowledge, did any of the CDS contracts that Deutsche Bank dealt in have any provisions that would have triggered payments of collateral or notional even upon a decline in the market value of the bond as opposed to actual losses?
Most counterparty, you know, this is not my exact area,
okay,
but, you know, my understanding is most counterparty are required to post collateral according to the market price.
Which is separate from the movement of notional. Do you know how Deutsche Bank hedged its own exposure? If Deutsche Bank goes out and sells credit default swap protection to hedge fund investors, is it then buying that same protection from someone else? Or is it an intermediary and the two actual parties to the contract are?
As a bank as a whole?
I just mean what you did with Mr. Lippman.
Okay.
Is there a better way to ask? Yeah.
You were pitching to shorts.
Yeah.
Once someone took the short position, who took the long position?
We took the long position, but we... that's, you know, how the way that we making market, and we you know, it's very well known that our desk is on a large short position as well, and because the position itself costs payment every month, so we want to make market to subsidize the payment. So basically, we are paying the protection seller or the for the short position we have, and it's we want the market to flow through us so that we can charge a toll, so that the toll itself will subsidize the payment we make to the protection center.
And so,
sorry, but so who was taking?
This may actually be. I mean, you're going to talk to Greg.
Just to your knowledge, were the longs mostly in CDOs or mostly also single name investors?
Who was the seller of credit default swap protection to Deutsche Bank?
The seller of there might be, you know, a bunch of them, but you probably should ask Greg on this. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, were you, so your presentation is labeled shorting and focused on the reasons why someone with a particular view might want to short. Were you also involved in making other presentations with other analyses to long investors?
I don't think I am involved in that part of the trade. I think that my understanding was the trade, you know, there are so many protection sellers who want to sell protection, they want to get exposure. It's much easier job
were really only to the potential shorts.
Yeah, given that, you know, I'm such a well-known, you know, like bearish guy in the market. I mean that, you know, I assume that my view has been published enough. I am the last best person to actually go on. But, you know, like I did talk to people who wants to get long, and either they want to know, you know, how does this thing work, you know, like, you know, so But, you know, I can talk to them at the fact that, you know, how does the thing work. But I don't I did not make an effort to, you know, to, you know, get into a long position because.
You mentioned that Deutsche Bank wanted to take a toll on making the market in the short position to subsidize Deutsche Bank's own short position.
Yeah.
Do you know what the difference was, what the spread was that Deutsche Bank was able to take?
I do not necessarily know, but that's several
Greg
points.
Should know.
Several points.
Okay. Do you know how big Deutsche Bank's short position was?
In billions?
In billions. Would that be considered a proprietary position?
I think we consider that our inventory.
Inventory.
Yeah.
So you could presumably sell it at some point if you wanted to. Those are all I have for specific questions. I am curious, and something I like to do is, I'm sure there are questions that we haven't asked, and I explained that the role of the commission at the beginning of our discussion this morning, and I'm just wondering if you have any general views on the role of credit derivatives in the financial crisis that you think are relevant for us to be thinking about or looking into as we continue our investigation.
I have, you know, formed some of my own view. That's purely my opinion. I know a lot of people blame the credit derivative as, you know, has triggered the crisis. I think this is, I disagree with that opinion. I think that, you know, it's akin to blame the mirror for someone who is ugly. So
the mirror.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the root causes of the crisis is really the excess of liquidity that we had on the market. We had investors worried about how can, you know, there's no places to put their money at work. And their bosses require them to seeking the highest yield in the market, and therefore they are very eager to get into the CDOs and everything. And the CDO in turn buy, you know, the BBB tranches in mortgage, you know, securities because they are highest yield things there, and that drives down the pricing for the mortgage loans. And that in turn caused the lenders to lend as much as easy as they can to borrowers. And that drives up the housing price because the mortgage is such easy to get. And that actually caused people to worry about that they cannot get on the bus because if they miss this bus. So that, you know, like it, in some sense, CDS actually helped to sort of put a brake on that, because you imagine that if those money, you know, the investor, the money who they cannot buy the synthetic CDO, they would have to buy the real CDO, the cash CDO, and that would actually, you know, that money will flow to the lenders, and the lenders would have to make more loans to get that. So if there is a synthetic CDO, it actually divert money from the cash CDOs. So instead of like making more loans and making housing bubble even larger, this actually, you know, cause the housing bubble, you know, prevent housing bubble from getting larger. And I know that, you know, lenders would blame, you know, because, you know, the CDS, so you short the market, so you cause the home price to crash. Well, I think it's wrong, because the housing market has to crash. It's not because there is suddenly CDS. You know, because when the CDS started, nobody wants to, you know, like there are very few people wants to buy it. CDS become popular when the housing market gets into the trouble in the first place. So, so I would think that, you know, when something that's, you know, it's a Ponzi scheme also, you know, like this someone who actually called this Ponzi scheme and causing less people to get into the Ponzi scheme, therefore the Ponzi scheme crashed. Would you blame that person actually called this the Ponzi scheme? So,
It's an interesting point that you raise, and just to try to sort of think about it in a slightly different way, I'm just curious for your reaction to the idea that if you hadn't had the synthetic CDO market, that there would have been a finite limit at some point on how many mortgages could have been made, and so the cash CDO market could presumably have died a natural death without the synthetic market. Is that a
counterpoint to?
I'm asking if you'd considered that point.
It might be because, you know, when everybody, you know, on the earth gets a mortgage, you cannot get a mortgage anymore. But, you know, that can happen, but it probably happens, it will delay the process probably 2 more years. But I think we probably get much more painful than we have already experienced. I'm sorry, a lot, you know, it's already very painful, but it could be worse.
It's an interesting perspective. Kim,
we haven't talked a lot about ABX. Let me start in a slightly different place. Another perhaps counterpoint. I'd like to talk in terms of hypotheses. So another hypothesis is that the development of synthetics allowed dealers and others to hedge their positions so that the creators, those involved in the chain of securitization and creation of the mortgages, perhaps might have created less, but for their new ability to hedge. Do you have a view on that? It may be that the time series of the development of synthetics was different, so you'd have a factually different.
I'm sorry, I don't really. Could you repeat that question?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
That the development of various synthetic abilities to short mortgages provided the ability in the first instance for those who were naturally long mortgages because they were part of the securitization process, whether they were providing warehouse financing or otherwise taking long positions in the mortgage market. So that the ability for those players to short allowed them to create more because they could, you know, if they were hedging, they could have higher risk limits or they could take greater risks because they were hedging.
That would assume that there will be unlimited buyers of the risk. Apparently, you know, there are a limited buyer for the mortgage exposure, and they either buy the cash or buy synthetic. So I would say yes, it will give dealers ability to hedge the position, but that instead of that creates more the more products in the market, you know, it probably would, like my original point, it diverts the demand from the cash market to the synthetic market, so that sort of it cooled down the cash market a little bit. I don't know whether, well, you know, sort of you can argue, you know, like this is really a chicken and egg, you know, question. I guess there is no. It's an interesting question, but I tend to think that the synthetic would the net effect of the synthetic actually put some brake on the on the creation of the mortgage mortgage product.
Another hypothesis is it did both at different times.
Yes, yes. I think it's an interesting point, and I think it's there is no. I think it must be valid at a certain point, and it must be valid microly. So, if we're looking at an individual firm at a specific time, that might be the case. But as an aggregate, as a macro effect, I think I more tends to believe that my version because I think otherwise you would have to have unlimited demand.
So the other concern about synthetics, which is it is that somehow the losses were redistributed to different types of institutions than would have occurred if you were only dealing with a cash market. Do you have a view on that?
I think that's fair. That's a fair point. And you would have, if there is no synthetic, if there is no synthetic product, then you would have. There will still be the same type of guy who buy mortgage products. They will have to buy more mortgage product, be it cash. They can only buy cash, but those shorters, those on the like a macro hedge fund or like long short hedge fund, they would have to only short the stock, the equity of all those financial companies, and there will be the problem. The thing is the housing market probably will grow even to the sky even a little bit higher before it starts to crash. And there will be a disconnect from the two markets. The synthetic product, the mortgage derivative, give a tool for those hedge funds to express a view directly into the fixed income sector, and therefore they become a party to play in the fixed income factor. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? I tend to think it's a good thing. I do understand that they probably will things can be better regulated, so that the problem for me is not the problem for me is that I think the financial crisis happens not because of there is something that you actually get across the market. I think it's because before that happens, because there is no break to put in one part of the system, that system goes runs amok, and then somehow suddenly people realize that something happened. Be that catalyst, maybe it's a credit default derivative or things like that. That probably play as a catalyst, but it's not the root cause. The root cause is really that one part of the system has been overheating and around, run amok.
What sort of breaks, in your view, could have prevented this?
I would think that the system itself should check the sanity of the anything, any good idea, if wrong out of control, is become a disaster, right? Home ownership is a good idea, definitely, but if you overstretching it and it become a problematic. Enough liquidity in the system is a good idea. I think it is, but if there's too much of it, that's the problem. So, there should be some regulation about how much the risk some portion of the system can take, you know, a financial institution can take. So put a, you know, like a reasonable control on that, right? A, you know, so I think, you know, like the, I think the financial crisis, again, is caused because everybody thinks something is a good idea and they just overdid it. And,
thank you very much.